When I was 7 or 8 years old, my mom had a major back surgery. She'd been struggling with back pain for a long time. A number of her discs needed to be fused together. When surgery's done these days, almost as soon as the surgery's finished, patients are encouraged to get up, to be moving around. Movement is a significant part of the journey of recovery. But back when my mom had the surgery done, the advice she was given by the surgeon was to essentially lay on her back for about 6 months. That's the way things were done. And so she did. She'd wake up in the morning, she would make her way over to the couch, and myself and my two brothers, we'd put socks on her feet, we'd bring her breakfast to the couch, or in bed, we did laundry, we made meals, and all of that. One day, I was about, I think I was 8 or 9 years old, and with my mom's help, I had put together a bunch of soup in a crock pot. And it had been in this crock pot for a long time. Things in crock pots get very hot, boiling hot. And my younger brother, who was about 6 at the time, wanted to see what was in the pot. And so he reached up, but he couldn't quite reach. And as he pulled it towards himself, it began to tip. I was right beside my brother, and I managed to push him out of the way and to catch the pot before it entirely fell. But of course, all of the liquid fell on me. It soaked my shirt, and it burned my arms. See if you can fill in the blank for me. If you walk through fire, you're going to get... Let's try one more. If you walk off a cliff, you're going to... If you put your hand... If you slam your hand in a car door, it's going to hurt or break. Of course. It's the law of consequences. Smoking too much over time leads to lung cancer. Drinking too much alcohol over time leads to liver damage. If we eat way too much and exercise way too little over time, it leads to the breakdown of our bodies. It's the law of consequences. The East Coast Canadian band Great Big Sea once sang the following lyric, "I want to be consequence free." Now, the singer of this song wasn't talking about finding freedom from things like the force of gravity or anything like that. He's longing for the freedom from constraints that bind all of us. He wants to speak his mind, say whatever he wants, even something unkind, without it coming back to bite him. And I think we're not all that different. We want to age. We want to grow in experience and wisdom, but without losing any of the strength or the beauty or the vitality that belongs to the young. We want to take risks without the possibility of failing. We want to step into or out of relationships without causing or experiencing heartache. We want to live consequence-free. But here's what I've been thinking about all week. Is it actually possible to avoid the consequences of our choices? Can we fashion dividers in our lives so that what happens in one area of our life doesn't affect the rest of the areas of our life? Years ago now, I was in my early 30s and I was pastoring at a church in Calgary. And I got a knock on my office door one afternoon. I opened it to find one of our congregants was standing there. I'm going to refer to him as Rob. Rob had only been a Christian for about 18 months. His young adult daughter had first come to Christ, then his wife, and he followed after the two of them. And Rob followed his daughter and his wife in becoming actively involved in our church. I got to know Rob because I was leading an Alpha course and Rob was a part of the gathering. And over time, Rob really began to grow in his faith. But on the day that Rob appeared at my door, it was really clear that Rob was agitated. But more, he was angry. Now, Rob was not an angry man. He was gentle. He was kind at almost every time I experienced him. But standing there that day, looking into his eyes, I saw lightning bolts. Rob had just discovered that morning that his wife was sleeping with his daughter's best friend, a young man. And he knew exactly where this guy lived. And he said to me, "Pastor Mark, I've got a crowbar in my trunk, and I'm on my way over to this guy's house. Give me one good reason why I shouldn't beat him bloody." And I said the first thing that came to mind. I said, Rob, here's a reason. If you act on your impulses, you're going to jail for a very, very long time. When we're angry, as the expression goes, we see red. Anger blinds us. It narrows our perspective. It clouds our thinking. It impedes good judgment. As it says in James chapter 1, human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. But anger is far from the only dangerous influence that affects us. The spirit of pride or envy or comparison can set your soul on fire. Just as easily, the spirit of rejection, spirit of shame and fear and so on. It's the law of consequences. What goes in will come out. What we think, desire, and do will shape our lives. We're about 5 weeks into our series through 1 and 2 Samuel, focusing on the life of David. And we've captured one of the catchphrases, one of the primary descriptors that is attached to David. We're told over and over again that David was a man after God's own heart. And in a biblical way of thinking, the heart represents the very center of a person's life. In one sense, a person after God's own heart is like a hawk. They've set their gaze upon God, watching for every move, listening for every word that He speaks. People who have centered their life around God are asking the question, where is God? What is He doing? What is He saying? What does He love? What does He avoid? Now, to this point in the book of 1 Samuel, we've seen Saul be rejected as king because of his ongoing rebellion against God. And subsequent to Saul's rejection as king, God chooses and anoints David. He's going to be the future king. And unaware of this choice, Saul unwittingly brings David into his own household, into the palace. He gives him opportunities to shine, and David's star begins to rise. And the more brightly David shone, the more fearful and angry Saul became. We've already heard that Saul orchestrated 6 different attempts on David's life. And when the last attempt failed, David fled and went into hiding. Last weekend, Pastor Brendan was preaching from 1 Samuel 24 and 26. We see David on the run, hunted and harassed by Saul in the wilderness. On these 2 different occasions, Saul literally fell into David's hands. He could have taken his life, but instead he practiced mercy. Like God Himself, who willingly shows mercy to those who stand against Him. But sandwiched in between chapter 24 and 26 is chapter 25. And for the first time in this chapter, we see a clear shadow side in David. He's still a worshiper. He's still a loyal subject and warrior. But here in chapter 25, we see David burning with anger. He's going to take what he wants and destroy whoever stands in his way. Consequences be damned. So for an inside look at what's going on in David's life, I want to invite you to take your Bible with me and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 25. If you've got a smartphone or a tablet, feel free to fire up your Bible app. If you're using the blue Bible in front of you, our text is on page 234. And I'm going to read, just to begin, the first 3 verses. Now Samuel died. And all Israel gathered for his funeral. They buried him at his house in Ramah. Then David moved down to the wilderness of Maon. There was a wealthy man from Maon who owned property near the town of Carmel. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and it was sheep shearing time. This man's name was Nabal, and his wife Abigail was an intelligent and beautiful woman. But Nabal, a descendant of Caleb, was crude and mean in all of his dealings. One of the things that's important to know about Hebrew narrative and reading it well is that Hebrew narrative can be incredibly subtle. Not only must we take note of what is being said, but we need to pay careful attention to how these things are being said. So after announcing the death of Samuel, we're introduced to 3 different people: David, Nabal, and Abigail. David we know, but the other 2 we've not been introduced to before. And what's interesting is that Abigail is first named and then described. Nabal, however, is first described and then named. And in doing so, the narrator wants us to know that the most important thing about Nabal is the most important thing to Nabal, namely his wealth. It's the first thing we hear about him. He's very wealthy. He's a rich landowner, so rich, in fact, that his property extends to sustain a flock of 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep. Verse 3 describes the way other people encounter or experience Nabal. He's mean-spirited. He's disrespectful. He's short-tempered. And to add injury to insult, we find out later on in the text that Nabal's name means fool or foolish. And so, to recap, in Nabal we find a wealthy, mean-spirited, short-tempered fool. By contrast, his wife is described as being intelligent and beautiful. Let's continue on in the story, beginning in verse 4. When David heard that Nabal was shearing his sheep, he sent 10 of his young men to Carmel with the following message for Nabal: "Peace and prosperity to you, your family, and everything you own. I'm told that it is sheep shearing time. While your shepherds stayed among us near Carmel, we never harmed them, and nothing was ever stolen from them. Ask your own men, and they will tell you this is true. So would you be kind to us? Since we come at a time of celebration, please share any provisions you might have on hand with us and with your friend David." David's young men gave this message to Nabal in David's name, and they waited for a reply. This is how Nabal replied. "Who is this fellow David?" Nabal sneered to the young men. "Who does this son of Jesse think he is? There are lots of servants these days who run away from their masters. Should I take my bread and water and my meat that I've slaughtered for my shears and give it to a band of outlaws who comes from who knows where?" So David's young men returned and told him what Nabal had said. "Get your swords," was David's reply, as he strapped on his own. Then 400 men started off with David, and 200 remained behind to guard their equipment. This is a side of David we haven't seen before, reacting in anger. Some have suggested that even by sending 10 young men to Nabal to ask for provision, David's playing the role of the Italian mobster, saying, "Hey, listen, look at what we've done for you, and now it's time to pay up. Give us our protection money." I just don't see it. David has the firepower to take whatever he wants, but he doesn't take, he asks. He asks, and even as he's asking, he speaks this threefold blessing over Nabal. "Please," he says, "share any provisions you might have on hand." And Nabal responded to David's request with a clear insult. It's clear from the insult, he knows exactly who David is. Nabal's response shouldn't surprise us, because again, we all live with the consequences of our choices. One can't have a love affair with money and live in generosity towards others. They're incompatible. Nabal loved his money too much to let it go. But it's one thing to say no to David's request, and it's another thing entirely to intentionally insult Israel's premier battle chief. None of us lives consequence-free. David and his men strap on their swords, bent on destruction. Verse 21 gives us an inside look into what was going on in David's mind. We read, "A lot of good it did to help this fellow, Nabal. We protected his flocks in the wilderness, and nothing he owned was lost or stolen. But he's repaid me evil for good. May God strike me and kill me if even one man of his household is still alive tomorrow." Now remember, just a chapter earlier, in chapter 24, David, on the run from Saul, the man who's trying to kill him, who's had 6 different attempts on his life, and when Saul literally falls into his lap, David chooses to bless, to forgive, to let Saul go. And yet, here, the mercy that David showed to Saul, the patience with those who oppressed him, and even the refusal to take matters into his own hands, all of this is gone. And because of an insult, he's strapping on a sword, bent on murder. Consequences be damned. Let's get back to the story. and the intervention of Abigail. In verse 14, we're told that a servant was there in the background, listening to what Nabal was saying to David's young men. And after the young men went off in a huff, the servant went straight to Abigail. Verse 17, the servant said to her, "You need to know what just happened and figure out what to do, for there's going to be trouble for our master and his whole family. He's so ill-tempered that no one can even talk to him." And Abigail knew this to be true. She didn't talk to her husband. Instead, she acted quickly. She got her servants together, they rounded up a whole pile of food, and they set out on the road immediately to find David to see if they could avert disaster. When she saw David dressed for war, she fell at his feet, and this is what she said, verse 25. "I know Nabal is a wicked and ill-tempered man. Please don't pay any attention to him. He is a fool, just as his name suggests. Now, my Lord, as surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, since the Lord has kept you from murdering and taking vengeance into your own hands," when it came to Saul, "let all of your enemies and those who try to harm you be as cursed as Nabal is." Verse 28, "The Lord will surely reward you with a lasting dynasty, for you were fighting the Lord's battles and you have not done wrong. Verse 30, "When the Lord has done all He promised and has made you lead of Israel, don't let this be a blemish on your record. Then your conscience won't have to bear the staggering burden of needless bloodshed and vengeance." Abigail, in her wisdom, kept David from making a terrible mistake, the mistake of spilling innocent blood. Abigail reminded David who God was, what God had promised to him, who he was. He didn't take matters into his own hands. He trusted the Lord with his honor, with his rise, with everything. And as Abigail spoke, David listened. She stopped his course of action before it was too late. Abigail was right. David didn't have to defend his own honor. His life was in God's hands, and he belonged to God to be raised up or set aside according to God's timing and purpose. David relented. He went back to where he came from. Abigail went back to her house, and we're told that she discovered a party was going on, and her husband Nabal was in a drunken stupor. And so she didn't bother talking to him. What would be the point? Instead, she waited until the next day when the stupor had worn off some, and she told Nabal what had happened, what David was going to do, what she had done to avert disaster, and we're told that something struck Nabal. We're not sure. Heart attack, stroke, something like that. But he was bedridden for the next 10 days, and then he died. The story concludes with David asking Abigail to become his wife. Abigail agreed, but if you read verses 43 and 44, to me at least, it sounds a troubling note. We read that David also married Ahinoam from Jezreel, making both of them, Ahinoam and Abigail, his wives. Saul, meanwhile, had given his daughter, Michal, David's wife, to a man from Galim named Palti, son of Laish. Three marriages, three wives. David sent for Abigail, and she came. But we're left to wonder, was this the marriage born of love, or lust, or power? A landowner as wealthy as Nabal would have been well known all throughout the southern kingdom. Abigail's wisdom and beauty would have been equally well known. In becoming David's wife, Abigail brought all of the wealth of Nabal to his household. She also brought all of her influence to his household. And in that time and our time, wealth and influence always equals power. Years later, David was crowned king right near where this all took place, in Hebron. Now, David didn't confiscate Nabal's wealth. In one sense, he didn't take matters into his own hands. But in another sense, David made an alliance, he stockpiled wealth, and he secured his future. And here's the thing. While this was normal behavior for kings of his age, I have to think this kind of behavior was out of line with the King of Heaven. Verse 43 mentions that David married Ahinoam of Jezreel, another marriage, another alliance. In Deuteronomy 17, God gave clear instructions to all of the Israelite kings: don't amass wealth, don't amass wives, and don't attempt to consolidate power. In doing so, you're sidelining me and taking matters into your own hands. And yet, David is taking his first steps down a very dangerous path. He's on his way to kingship, but what kind of kingship? And at what cost? What we do shapes who we become. None of us can avoid the law of consequences. In the time remaining, I want to offer two brief points of application. Here's the first. All of us are on a journey of becoming. Our lives are not static. We are being shaped and changed and formed. And one of the chief agents in this process are all of the choices that we make. Now, more often than not, we tend to think in binary terms, in or out, black or white, good or bad. But life isn't that simple. Our hearts aren't that simple. One moment, David is merciful, and the next, he's hell-bent on vengeance. Our hearts are like a field in which weeds and wheat grow up together. Like Nabal and Abigail and David, our character is being shaped by what we think about, by what we desire, by what we do. Each choice is like a brushstroke on the canvas of our lives. I want you to stop for a moment and just consider the power, the life-shaping power that's found in the choices we make. Every day we make choices that affect us at school, at work, in our neighborhoods or families. We make choices about entertainment, about money, about time, and how we'll spend it. Have you stopped to consider where your choices are leading you these days? Or what your choices are producing in you? We can choose to open ourselves to God's love, or to the love of others, or we can hold God and others at a distance for fear of being hurt. We all live with the consequences of these choices. In this world, all of us experience hurt, misunderstanding, and rejection. Jesus, the Son of David, knew this firsthand. In the face of accusation and rejection, Jesus entrusted his reputation to the Father. He made the choice repeatedly to let go of bitterness, anger, and the desire to get even. On the cross, Jesus spoke a few final words. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. The choice to forgive and seek reconciliation leads down one path. The choice to hold on to bitterness and anger leads down a very different path. And again, we live with the consequences of our choices. I began my story telling you about my friend from church, whose name was Rob. When he walked into my office, he felt betrayed. He was wounded. He was angry. He was seeing red. By the time he left my office, he surrendered his crowbar, physically surrendered it, and metaphorically. But his journey forward was not nice or neat. When he confronted his wife, she chose to walk away from the marriage, from the family, from Jesus. She wanted to be free to do whatever she wanted. And this priority didn't square with marriage or family or Jesus. And Rob chose a very different path. He did the excruciating work of letting go of his marriage, of these wounds of betrayal and rejection, of anger. Over time, he forgave his wife, although she never came back. 5 years after I left Calgary, at this time I was already here at this church, Rob sent me a long letter outlining where he was at and how God had transformed his heart, where he was growing. I'm just so proud of Rob and his choices. In the attempt to avoid pain, some of us seek to make our lives bulletproof, building layers of protection, seeking every advantage, desperately trying to control everyone and everything. But we can't live this way and avoid the consequences. So as you think about your own life, my question for you is, are you fighting God or are you embracing Him these days? Are you convinced that His way is right and good, or are you trying to convince Him that your way is right and good? The choices we make shape our becoming. So the question is, who are you becoming? Here's the second point of application. Embrace the gift of others. In the text that we've been looking at this morning, you may have noticed that while God's name is mentioned, we don't see His direct activity, and we don't hear His voice speaking even once. But here's the thing. God wasn't absent. God is never absent or inactive. He was working behind the scenes to bring Abigail to David. David needed wise counsel, and God provided an incredibly wise woman. Now, instead of driving straight to the young man's house first, Rob came by the church. At the height of his anger and his desperation, Rob knew he needed another perspective. David had set his mind on a course of action, and he wasn't going to listen to anyone, but then Abigail showed up, and what a difference she made. David listened to this wise woman, he learned something, he let go of vengeance, and the course of his life was different because of it. All of us live with the consequences of our choices, and one of the consequences of this age of independence in which we live is blindness. We act alone. We trust ourselves. We don't invite others in. Proverbs 28:26 says, "Those who trust themselves are fools, but those who walk in wisdom are kept safe." More often than not, the providence of God is experienced through the provision of others. More often than not. So I want to ask, these days, who have you invited in to the inner counsel of your mind and heart? Do you have a group of close friends or advisors? Are you connected to a small group? Do you regularly see a mentor or a spiritual director? Who are you sharing your thoughts and plans and life with? Because you're not meant to do it alone. Like David, our heart is like a field in which weeds and wheat grow up together. Like Nabal and David and Abigail, our character is being shaped by what we think and desire and do. Each choice we make is like a brushstroke on the canvas of our lives. And the most important choice we can make is to live in connection to Jesus. In a few moments, we're going to gather around the Lord's table, and I'm going to invite you to come forward and tear off a piece of bread and dip it in the cup and then eat. And in one sense, this could hardly be considered a meal. It's just a taste, really. And so what's going on as we participate in the Lord's Supper? Through this symbolic act, we open ourselves to the reality of Christ's presence and power here among us today. Here at this table, we confess that we have need, and Jesus Himself is our supply. We're all on this journey of becoming, and we need His intervention. We need His strength, His wisdom, His forgiveness, His healing, His transformation. On the night before Jesus went to the cross, He shared a final meal with His disciples. At one point during the meal, He took some bread, He broke it, He gave thanks for it, and then distributed it among His disciples, saying, "This is my body which is for you. Eat this in remembrance of me." And in the same way, after supper, He shared with them a cup of wine, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you." And we know that at the cross, Jesus' body was broken for us, that we might experience healing and wholeness. His blood was shed for us, that we might be forgiven and set free, that our sin would be made white as snow. And so this morning, if you're hungry and thirsty for God's provision, then I want to invite you to come to Jesus. At this time, I'd like to invite the worship team to come and join me on stage.